Sinclair, and this is Ideas. Not long ago, most people thought stomach ulcers were caused by too much stress, a bad diet, even aspirin. Then, in the early 1980s, an Australian medical student named Barry Marshall began noticing strange spiral-shaped bacteria in the stomach lining of people with ulcers. In 1984, he and a colleague published a paper describing these unidentified curved bacteria. But few people took notice. It wasn't until Marshall actually drank a batch of these bacteria himself and subsequently came down with serious stomach pains that the medical community finally took him seriously. Today, there's widespread consensus that bacteria are the primary cause of stomach ulcers. This discovery marked the beginning of what's become a fundamental reassessment of the role of bacteria in chronic diseases, everything from rheumatoid arthritis to inflammatory bowel disease to multiple sclerosis to, more recently, heart disease. This two-part idea series investigates the role of bacteria in making us sick, including a controversial new finding that threatens to overturn conventional wisdom about a nasty infection called Lyme disease. We'll also hear some startling new ideas about the fundamental causes of disease, ideas that will surprise you. This is The Bacteria Revolution by science writer Coleman Jones.
Bacteria are the most ancient and simplest of organisms. Most are perfectly harmless, but some are deadly. Over the last century, the medical profession has developed ways to track down and kill the bacteria that make us sick. Uncovering the causes of acute infections, like diarrhea, is relatively easy. But what about the mysterious chronic diseases? Are bacteria involved here, too? Take Lyme disease, for example. When it first develops, you can see the bacteria that cause it. But then something peculiar happens. Some people who are treated with antibiotics continue to suffer, though blood tests say the disease has been cured. Are the bacteria hiding somehow? Are other bacteria hiding in other diseases? Debates continue to rage over what causes various chronic diseases, from Alzheimer's to AIDS. In some cases, the debate takes place quietly in the pages of medical journals. In other cases, angry patients have forced the issues out in the open, like here in New York, where about 350 people have gathered for the 12th International Conference on Lyme Disease.
I'd like to welcome you to the 12th International Conference on Lyme Disease and other spirochetal and tick-borne diseases. I think that we have organized...
The conference is sponsored by the Lyme Disease Foundation, headed by Karen Vanderhoof-Forschner.
I got involved in Lyme disease because in 1985, I wound up getting bitten by a bug that I thought was just not important and didn't really care about it. I knew what it was. And then during the pregnancy with my first child, wound up getting all of these multi-system problems. You know, I had loss of taste and smell. I had some irregular heartbeats. I had significant joint problems. I had profound fatigue. And they weren't really sure what it was. I had a rash. I had a number of things occurring, but pretty much forgot about it as being related to this little tiny bite that I had had. And when my son was born, he had difficulty and evidence of a brain infection, which they couldn't pin down for a number of years. And then eventually we realized that he had Lyme disease. About a year and a half later, it was confirmed through a blood test.
And so Forschner and her husband decided to form the Lyme Disease Foundation.
Since our son turned out to suffer from this, and we had two dogs and three cats that also had it, and I had it, we felt that it would be a good thing that both my husband and I could do. And we were hoping that it would find solutions for our son, which unfortunately it didn't, and he died in 91. He was five.
Lyme disease is spread by insects called deer ticks. But it's only one of several diseases spread by ticks. From Colmar, Pennsylvania, Dr. Gregory Bach.
About 10 years ago, everybody thought that it was this particular bacteria of Lyme creating these horrible problems with individuals. And now we're finding that there are co-infections with unusual names such as human granulitic Ehrlichiosis in human, monocytic Ehrlichiosis. The other disease that we're seeing that's very prevalent is a disease called Babesiosis. The easiest way to think about that disease is that it's the brother of malaria. We're also seeing another phenomenon that occurs with this where people become enraged. And instead of having the normal ability to hold back when becoming upset, they just get enraged. I've had several patients with these disorders try to commit suicide. I had a lady that took a chainsaw to her furniture. And we're now recognizing these in possible cases where individuals commit crime may have these diseases underlying.
Sorting out all the various symptoms caused by tick-borne diseases is no picnic, and both the detection and the treatment of Lyme are surrounded by controversy. This is Dr. Kenneth Liegner from the New York Medical Center in Armonk, New York.
Many of my colleagues, particularly in academia, have more or less staked the reputations that Lyme disease is easily diagnosed and easily cured. And it is my definite conviction, based on working with patients over many years, that this is not the case, that many patients are difficult to diagnose, and that we may not even have the means of curing this infection with currently available methods.
These uncertainties are front and center at the New York conference, which is chaired by UCLA professor James Miller.
Some of the clinical manifestations early on can be very subtle and very generalized and referable to other diseases. This makes it very difficult to diagnose. And the blood tests that we have, unfortunately, have problems associated with them in terms of whether they are specific, and in many cases whether they're sensitive and reproducible.
This uncertainty over the blood tests makes it hard for doctors to say whether a patient really has the infection or not. Dr. Charles Ray Jones works in pediatric and adolescent medicine in Hamden, Connecticut.
I have 1,500 children with Lyme disease, ranging in age from 1 day to 18 years of age. And judging from the pattern of presentation, I feel that it's way underdiagnosed, way undertreated.
When Dr. Jones says underdiagnosed and undertreated, he means that many cases of Lyme are never identified by doctors. Even among those people who do receive treatment, many still go on to suffer a variety of ills, ranging from headaches and depression to arthritis. But it's not clear whether this hodgepodge of symptoms is due to the Lyme disease or something else. Lyme disease got its name from the towns where it was first identified, Lyme and Old Lyme, Connecticut. In 1975, unusual arthritis cases were being reported in children. Then, in 1982, a type of bacteria known scientifically as Borrelia burgdorferi was isolated from deer ticks and was later confirmed as the cause of the illness. Recently, using high-tech DNA techniques, researchers have found evidence of this bacterium dating back to Paleolithic times. Gregory Bach.
There was a 14-year-old male in the Louisiana swamps. This was a Paleolithic individual, and they looked at his knee joints, and they said that they saw a type of arthritis, but it wasn't juvenile arthritis. It has a certain type of etching in the joints. They took the DNA out of the knee joint and expanded it and pulled out the organism of Lyme borrelia. So we're looking at a bacteria that's been around as long as perhaps man has, but now just being recognized.
Kenneth Liegner.
We know that it must have been in nature affecting people for millennia. What did we call the conditions that it induced? We called them by other names, never suspecting that there might be an infectious basis to these illnesses.
The impression I'm getting from this conference is that there's unanimous agreement that Lyme is underdiagnosed. Anybody disagree with this?
Okay, well, this conference reflects one side in what basically is a war within the profession on the nature of Lyme disease. There are many others, and particularly academicians, who have basically staked their reputations that there is no such thing as chronic Lyme disease and that Lyme disease is easily diagnosed and easily treated.
Chronic Lyme disease refers to a whole constellation of persistent symptoms, which are often mistaken for other conditions. The notion that Lyme disease can persist in a chronic form, causing all sorts of problems for patients, even after treatment, is one that's been hard for some researchers to accept. Sam Donta is a leading Lyme specialist who works at Boston University's School of Medicine.
When I had gone initially to some workshops that were held by some of the early experts, they presented a story that seemed to be a good story, and they would say, well, okay, you only need to treat for 2 or 4 weeks, and that's it. And then when I started to see patients, and it became clear to me that they started to get better on the antibiotic but didn't finish getting better, that it didn't make any sense. It wasn't logical that you arbitrarily decided ahead of time as to how much antibiotic treatment to give. And then when I looked back at the individuals that were advocating this, they were advocating it without any firm scientific data, because we still don't have the tools that we need to measure what it is happening. For example, if you had a urine infection or a pneumonia, you could take specimens, see the bacteria, grow the bacteria, test the bacteria, and we can't do that in Lyme disease. The bacteria would appear to have gone into hiding someplace.
Sam Donta began comparing the standard blood tests for Lyme disease with more sophisticated tests. He became uneasy with the conventional wisdom on Lyme, established by the American government's Centers for Disease Control, the CDC.
I began to put the picture together, and when the CDC criteria for the laboratory diagnosis were established, it was clear to me that those were not accurate criteria. And the shame of that now is that physicians are still relying on a negative test as meaning a person doesn't have Lyme disease.
What you're saying really is that absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
That's correct. It's just you don't have the evidence that you would like to have to build up the case. So you have to move on and do whatever else. What are you going to do? Sit there?
While Dr. Donta and his colleagues are working to uncover the true extent of Lyme disease, others downplay the very notion of chronic Lyme. The insurance industry, for example, is often reluctant to pay for better tests or lengthier courses of treatment without clear evidence that patients are still infected. Karen Vanderhoof-Forschner.
I think that there's a lot of money out there to be made by having expert witnesses at trials for insurance companies to say who does and doesn't definitively have Lyme disease. So there is money to be made by those who feel that they can clearly and easily separate those who have the infection from those who are disease wannabes.
Here at the New York conference, there's lots of patients who have joined coalitions like the Lyme Disease Foundation to agitate for more research. Sam Donta.
Because patients aren't dying right and left with Lyme disease, you don't have the type of research interest and support that you do in a disease like AIDS. But from my perspective, Lyme disease by itself, let alone the other disorders of fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue, are pervasive.
Kenneth Liegner.
In the case of Lyme disease, there are so many different manifestations that I think we're going to find that Lyme disease has a role in a lot of things that we do not yet accept or realize.
Some patients are being called fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue, and if you served in the Persian Gulf War, Gulf War illness. And I think what's happening is we're dealing with a whole new set of disorders. And because, I don't know, some people haven't stretched their mind to think that maybe we need to think of these as a different model, then we've been spoiled with our antibiotics to treat acute disorders, that is, things like pneumonia and urinary tract infections that come rapidly and go away rapidly. And why it isn't pretty obvious, if you think about it, that that won't work, that you need longer periods of time. And it isn't like we don't have models. We have tuberculosis, we have leprosy, we have Q fever, we have fungal diseases, we have viral diseases like hepatitis, in which you just have to keep going long periods of time, and you see the benefit of doing that. And if you hadn't thought of doing that, then you might conclude prematurely that, oh, I treated them with antibiotics for 1 month. I even retreated them for a second month, and they didn't get better. So therefore, they couldn't possibly have an infection. You tend to dismiss it and say, well, the person made it up, or that's psychosomatic.
A psychosomatic illness is one that isn't caused by external factors like infection, but instead originates in the mind of the patient. It's a label often used by doctors when they just can't figure out what's making somebody sick. But now that doctors have better techniques for zeroing in on hidden infections, they're finding Lyme bacteria in all kinds of patients, even those who don't show the typical symptoms of Lyme. For example, at the New York conference, I spoke to Dr. Martin Fried, a New Jersey pediatrician who recently presented evidence of Lyme infection in patients with Crohn's disease, a serious inflammation of the bowel. Finding the Lyme germ in Crohn's patients is another intriguing part of the puzzle in this disease, which affects some 50,000 Canadians and whose precise cause has eluded medical researchers. Here at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto, Dr. Gordon Greenberg is performing what's called an endoscopy on a patient with Crohn's disease. It's a procedure that involves examining the inside of the bowel for signs of inflammation. It's useful for monitoring how well a particular treatment is working.
Okay, now you see this inflamed area here that's oozing a bit and ulcerated, and that's all Crohn's disease there, and that's recurrence around the anastomosis. That's what it looks like.
Right. Dr. Greenberg is a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto and head of the Division of Gastroenterology at Mount Sinai. He says it's not clear exactly what causes either Crohn's disease or another inflammatory bowel disease called ulcerative colitis.
There always has been the hypothesis or the concept that a single infectious etiology may be the cause of either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, but to date, no single bacteria or virus has clearly been linked with either disease. What does seem to be clear, however, from several lines of evidence, is that bacterial flora within the gut, at least in a secondary way, do perpetuate the inflammatory process in Crohn's disease. And this comes from several lines of evidence on the role of specific antibiotics, which we found to be particularly effective in helping to control the inflammation in Crohn's disease. I think more and more the concept is emerging that bacteria do play an important role and that selected antibiotics are quite helpful in the management of patients with Crohn's disease.
Turning to another bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, Dr. Martin Fried in New Jersey recently saw an 8-year-old girl with blood in her stool. It looked like a typical case of ulcerative colitis. He prescribed the standard medicine to calm the inflammation, but he also sent a tissue biopsy off for analysis. It revealed an active Lyme infection. He put the girl on antibiotics for a month, and she made a complete recovery.
After that treatment, I was able to easily take her off of both the antibiotic and the anti-inflammatory, and it hasn't come back. And that's not the nature of ulcerative colitis. Ulcerative colitis would come back, but an infection would go away if treated properly. I thought that's fascinating.
Neither Dr. Fried nor Dr. Greenberg are sure just what's going on in their patients, but the evidence certainly points to a role for bacteria. This uncertainty over causation extends as well to mysterious problems like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. Some think the Lyme bug may often be to blame here too. Others suspect a different organism called a mycoplasma. It's going to be a while until anybody knows for sure. On Ideas Tonight, our program is called The Bacteria Revolution, and I'm Coleman Jones. We're hearing about the rapidly developing suspicion and some recent proof that bacteria are responsible for a previously unimagined range of medical problems, and how scientists are working to sort this out.
I'm Professor Garth Nicholson. I'm the Chief Scientific Officer at the Institute for Molecular Medicine in Huntington Beach, California. We work on a variety of different chronic diseases, including chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, Belfort illness, rheumatoid arthritis, and a number of autoimmune diseases that have variant forms that can't be explained by the conventional theories that have been used to study these different illnesses, and these include multiple sclerosis, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, Graves' disease, and a number of other autoimmune disorders. The conventional thinking is that, for the most part, these diseases have an unknown origin. We don't know what causes the diseases. There seems to be a genetic element involved, a susceptibility element, and this is very poorly understood. And many of the diseases have at their onset some type of environmental exposure, exposure to chemicals, for example, or some other thing that seems to trigger the episodes of the illness, and then they progress. And we've been very interested in the role of infectious microorganisms like mycoplasmas and other small bacteria like chlamydia in the disease process. In some cases, these may be involved in triggering the disease, but for the most part, we think that these infections are involved in the progression of the disease, what makes the disease worse. We have found that the majority of patients with all of the diseases that I mentioned have infectious agents like mycoplasmas or chlamydia in their blood, and when treated for these agents, they can recover from their signs and symptoms, indicating that these infections were probably involved in at least the progression of the disease. We have found chronic infections in the majority of the patients that have these illnesses.
Dr. Nicholson and his institute have convinced the U.S. Department of Defense to conduct an $8 million clinical trial testing the effects of various antibiotics in patients with Gulf War syndrome. There's no research like this yet on patients suffering from what's thought to be chronic Lyme disease, because, of course, no one has been able to prove they're still infected with the Lyme bacterium. All that may change, however, with a bombshell discovery published a few months ago in a prominent medical journal, Infection. A group of American researchers say they've developed a complex technique that can find Lyme bacteria, previously undetectable, in the blood of patients with chronic disease. At the New York conference, I spoke to Hamid Moyad, a neurologist from Fort Worth, Texas, and co-author of the paper announcing the discovery.
In early 1997, I received a call from Dr. Stephen Phillips, who is an internist in Greenwich, Connecticut, specializing in Lyme disease, that he was interested in forming a collaboration effort with me to put up an article at National Institute of Health for the Lyme Disease Conference that year. And our friendship was through a professor emeritus of microbiology, namely Dr. Lida Matman.
In her lab in Detroit, this is Lida Matman.
The paper in Infection developed because Hamid and Stephen Phillips both had many Lyme patients, and they did have positive cultures, and they did have the evidence. We had the cultures that could be studied indefinitely.
Culturing an organism means growing it in the laboratory. The material used to grow it, the culture medium, has to be ingeniously designed. Lida Matman's recipe includes sugar, starch, and a variety of laboratory chemicals. Using this special patented culture medium, the Phillips research team claims to be able to grow the Lyme bacterium from the blood of patients with suspected chronic Lyme disease, patients who would be missed by the standard test. The publication of the Phillips paper, allegedly proving that patients with chronic Lyme disease are still infected with the Lyme bacterium, opens up a Pandora's box for patients and researchers alike. Hamid Moyad.
This would actually be the gold standard for diagnosis of Lyme disease, because if you're able to culture the bacteria, then no one can doubt the diagnosis anymore, especially in the chronic late stages, which the controversy is about.
What responses your work received?
We received a great deal of encouragement, and at the other extreme, many criticisms of the article at this time.
Why have people been critical?
Because at this time, we have had no other lab that has been able to reproduce the results of this article.
Rita Stanley first contracted Lyme disease many years ago and went on to start several support groups for Lyme patients. She remembers the excitement that initially greeted the Phillips paper.
This is exactly what the doctor ordered. You need a test like this. But as in everything else, things aren't cut and dried, especially in science. If you have a test in one laboratory, one has to have an eagle eye to really ask the questions, is this valid?
James Miller, program chairman of the New York Conference.
Well, I've read the paper. My own feelings about this is that I'd like to see it reproduced before I can totally accept it. It was a very, very provocative study, one that is very important, but yet one, because it's so provocative and because it's so important, needs to be reproduced in another laboratory. And I think that there are people who are trying to do that now.
You might wonder why we're discussing this highly technical debate over a laboratory procedure on a show like Ideas. Well, because it's a good illustration of the problems faced by any revolutionary finding in science, problems that have been well described by historians like Thomas Kuhn. When a paradigm-shattering discovery is presented, most people reject it because it doesn't fit with their picture of the world. But how can there be so much controversy over a paper that's been published in an eminent, peer-reviewed journal like Infection? It must be correct, right? Not necessarily. Even the editor of the journal tells me he's not sure if Phillips is right, since other labs still haven't been able to reproduce the results, at least not yet. Dr. Walter Margit, speaking from Munich.
Our reviewers are very, very skeptical, and I personally, I'm not very enthusiastic about this study. I have some very experienced Lyme disease researchers in our area. I have two colleagues in Munich and in Heidelberg. They both try this method and don't succeed.
One of those researchers is Dr. Dieter Hassler in Heidelberg.
In my knowledge, nobody worldwide has found such a lot of Borrelia in culture like Phillips. And we don't know exactly why. I can't believe that so much Borrelia survives. But I'm not sure. And I spoke to Dr. Margit and I told him we have to discuss it. We have to try if other work groups are able to find the same. It would be sensational.
You might be surprised that science articles get published before they're reproduced and verified. The publication is often an invitation to other researchers to try and duplicate the discovery. And so far, no Lyme researcher I've spoken to has been able to, in other words, to reliably cultivate the Lyme organism from the blood of patients allegedly suffering from the late stages of the disease. Richard Tilton, who's the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Microbiology.
If the work can be corroborated, if the work can be repeated, then it is truly remarkable. However, based on the paper that was published in Infection, we will have a very difficult time repeating and corroborating that work. We actually tried to corroborate it, and we prepared the media. Borrelia burgdorferi would not grow in it, and we were told at the time that the recipe was not correct for a number of reasons.
This culture technique that was developed by Dr. Matlin is a very reliable culture for this bacteria, and it took her apparently between 5 to 6 years to come up with this specific culture medium, and I have no doubt that it will be able to be reproduced soon.
And so it goes. Other experts I spoke to can't understand how this technique could so reliably find Lyme organisms from the blood of patients. Since the patients studied by Phillips and Moyad had already been aggressively treated with antibiotics, how is it possible for the Lyme bacteria to persist in the blood and remain unaffected by months, even years, of powerful treatments? The answer, may lie in a very important idea that surrounds the work of Phillips and colleagues. Disease-causing bacteria may be able to transform themselves into something that's resistant to standard treatment and invisible to the body's immune system. Dr. Moyad says the Lyme bacteria may take a form different from the usual coiled spiral shape characteristic of the so-called spirochete family to which it belongs. It turns out that spirochetes may be able to mutate, shed the wall that normally surrounds their cells, and roll themselves up into little balls, remaining impervious to the effects of both antibiotics and the body's immune system.
It is well known that when bacteria's encounter hostile environments, they use their adaptive mechanism and they mutate. In this case, it loses its cell wall, and it is very difficult to culture this. And in chronic form, it seems like that the predominant species would be this, and that's what we cultured in many of these patients that were in the study.
There's a lot of evidence, especially from the older syphilis literature, that suggests spirochetes, syphilis is caused by a spirochete, like Lyme, spirochetes can form what are called cysts, containing tiny granules that may form the basis for new daughter spirochetes. The discoverer of a Lyme-causing spirochete, Borrelia burgdorferi, is Willy Burgdorfer. The spirochete is named after him. Dr. Burgdorfer is a microbiologist, and he gave the keynote lecture at the New York conference, starting with some history about the idea of spirochete cysts hiding in the human body.
Now, this has been termed as granulation, that the spirochete falls into granules, and that these granules will then in turn be the source of additional new spirochetes. And it was considered as the mode of multiplication of this organism. There has been a second thought, and many physicians and many investigators said, no, there is no such a thing as granulation. Spirochetes divide by binary fission. They just separate in the middle, and they break into from one form into two forms. Now, with the detection of the Lyme disease spirochete, we began again to see these cysts forms along the Lyme disease spirochete, and having now sophisticated research procedures and techniques, it seems that the spirochete has the ability to go into these spherical stage as it infects the host.
What implications does this way of looking at spirochetes and their division and their reproduction, what implications does this have for the diagnosis of Lyme disease?
Well, it's probably the answer for the difficulties that we have in diagnosing the Lyme disease and other spirochetal diseases, in that we can demonstrate these cysts by microscopy, but once they are in the tissues of a patient, such as once in the brain, for instance, or in the central nervous system, in the spinal fluid, we can no longer detect them. And it is quite possible that this material that we cannot see by microscopy, that this material is responsible for producing prolonged and chronic disease.
I asked Dr. Burgdorfer whether he had seen the Phillips paper, which purports to have identified this same cyst, or bleb material as it's called, from the blood of Lyme patients. He hasn't seen it, I'm surprised to discover, so I show him a copy.
This is exactly what I'm talking about. This is exactly what... I never have seen this paper. This comes up for a European journal, right? Okay, and this is a big problem for scientists in the United States. We often work along our problems and forget that something like that may be also worked on in Europe, and is published in European journals that are not always available to us.
I asked Dr. Bergdorfer about the electron microscope photographs included in the paper.
Here you see these, what I call plaques. And these are shed by the mother spinal cord. And they are thought to be the germinative units of which or out of which the daughter spinal cords develop. Now, I personally believe that the significance of these blips as the agent responsible for prolonged and chronic disease is very important. And it may be the answer to the diagnosis of these chronic diseases, such as Lyme disease, because that's what we are looking for. We have to look for something that produces disease long after a patient did have his initial treatment, and then the relapse occurs after several months or after several years. And the question is, where does this relapse come from? Well, it may come from these surviving crystals or blips material that is in the tissues, and it stays there until the pressure and the antibiotic pressure or antibodies, the immune pressure is gone. And then when the conditions are right for its further development, they develop into typical spinal cords again. It is very difficult microscopically to see these blips or these atypical, morphologically atypical spinal cords in tissues. You don't see a typical long spinal cord. All that you see is granules and atypical material. And to demonstrate that this is actively living material is very difficult.
I'll just read for you the last two paragraphs of this paper. It is hoped that our work will help to end a medical controversy which has been going on for far too long. This study proves that chronic Lyme disease is a chronic infectious etiology, and that even antibiotic treatment, well in excess of current recommendations, is not necessarily curative. It is likely that Lyme borreliosis is vastly underdiagnosed. May this research help to focus the scientific community on effective curative therapies for patients with chronic Lyme disease.
I go along with this.
Dr. Bergdorfer and I proceed back to the conference, where we bump into Hamid Moya, one of the co-authors of the Phillips paper. Dr. Bergdorfer reminds him that the notion of a spirochetal life cycle was first proposed in the syphilis literature long ago.
It was published in 1961, and now, 40 years later, when I looked at Mrs. Byrne and Bergdorfer, I see the same things again, but now I begin to put two and two together. And this two and two is the spirochete uses this as a way to overcome its environment.
Actually, 2 years ago, we had a presentation with pictures, and you came and looked at it, and you said, well, maybe after that we gradually collected enough patients to make it into an article.
I back it up because of my own thinking about it. I have played with those spinal cords now for half a century, and you will walk out of here, and you will have two opinions. One opinion says you are all wrong, my friend, because all you are looking at is degenerating spinal cords that have nothing to do with any life cycle or any surviving mechanism. It's the end of them. And then you got the other guys who said, no, you are wrong, because I'm working with Lyme disease, and I can tell you that this material may be responsible for prolonged and chronic disease in the central nervous system or in any other tissue.
Kenneth Liebner.
One of the things that Dr. Bergdorfer pointed out was that earlier work in syphilis demonstrated the same thing, that the syphilis organism is not only present as a classical, beautiful spirochetal structure, but that it may adopt intracellular locations where it can be coiled and not be so obvious. It also may transform between a spirochetal form and a what they call the gemmae, G-E-M-M-A-E, gemmae, which are sort of cyst-like forms that you couldn't even recognize as having anything to do with syphilis or spirochete unless you had made a very detailed study of the nature of the syphilis organism in tissues under various conditions.
In other IDEAS programs, we've heard about how the syphilis spirochete may be causing a lot of what we call AIDS, despite remaining undetectable on blood tests. It's possible it might elude detection by turning into these cyst-like forms. James Miller.
There's never been any definitive proof that these so-called cyst-like forms occur in vivo, in an animal or in a human, with syphilis, with treponema pallidum. I've tried to prove it over many years and have not been able to.
How would you prove that, though? You can't put a microscope inside a human body.
I tried to prove it in my rabbit model using infected lymph nodes where I was never able to find organisms in their spirochetal form. Yet if you take the nodes and transfer them into naive rabbits that have never seen the disease, you actually get the development of the disease with the organisms. But we can't say whether or not there were these kinds of forms present or whether there were just very, very few spirochetes that I could not detect. There's no way that I could see, and I wear glasses because of all the years I've tried looking. You can inject one treponeme into the testicle of a rabbit, and you can produce disease. And there isn't any way that you can see one organism in a lymph node or in any other tissue.
Although James Miller doubts the existence of cyst-like forms of the syphilis spirochete, Willy Brugdorfer is confident the spirochete can take on this form.
Of course. That's already has been proven. The old literature, these formations of the spirochetes was considered to be a degeneration process due to the fact that spirochetes cannot survive under these conditions, and therefore they eventually will die, they no longer develop. But in those days, all the investigators had was the ordinary microscope to investigate how the bacteria on how the spirochetes looked like. And then once the spirochete developed into the cyst forms, they were no longer detectable by the ordinary microscope. So for them, that was the end of the spirochete, and they called it degeneration. There are a lot of scientists that say that has nothing to do with the further development. Yet there is now mounting evidence that this complex development and the ability of the organism to withstand unfavorable conditions, that this is true.
Okay, now watch this. They draw themselves inside their outer membrane.
We're at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where Lynn Margulis works. She's a biologist, and she's famous as one of the leading proponents of the Gaia hypothesis, the idea that the Earth as a whole acts like a gigantic living organism. Her concepts of symbiosis, the natural coexistence and co-development of different organisms, have transformed the study of evolution. Part of Dr. Margulis's work involves looking at microscopic spirochetes, not those found in the human body, but those found in the natural environment.
Spirochetes, free-living spirochetes, set a precedent. In our experience, it can survive. These spirochetes can survive desiccation in the sense that we have, in their natural habitat, removed muds for as long a period as a few years. And the muds look to the naked eye to be dry. There's no standing water in these preparations. We put that mud material back into supportive media for spirochetes, and we see spirochetes come out, the spirochete form, which suggests that spirochetes are hiding in a form that's not the swimming spirochete. Now, if we take those spirochetes that look fine and healthy and we put them into any kind of media that is threatening to them, they immediately round up, they pull in their bodies, and this is active. This is not a falling apart, like when you hit them with alcohol or something like that. It's not a lysis. It's not a falling apart. It's not immediate death, like you could easily cause immediate death by lots of negative conditions to acid and so on. It's not the extreme that you see immediate death. It's quite the contrary. You see active cells ballooning out their membranes, actively pulling in their bodies, and from electron micrographs, making these membranous structures. In fact, we have hundreds, thousands, probably 2,000 pictures of electron micrograph correlates of this.
Uh-huh.
Now watch this one. This is lower power. Watch this. Don't tell me that is sick and dying. Watch it. Watch it just right here.
Wow.
Watch them pop. Well, there's no doubt about this.
That's unbelievable.
Now look at the parent cells disintegrating and it's producing these things that can just go out and live.
Mm-hmm.
Making these non-spirochetal type morphologies is a normal part of the life history of spirochete bacteria. It's likely that organisms like Borrelia and Treponema that have been found in human tissue can burrow into tissue and make the same kind of resistant bodies and wait and come out when conditions are suitable 20 years later. I mean, I've got a couple of years in mud. Why not in the human body?
That was Lynn Margulis.
We keep them alphabetized by patient's name, and here they are.
In her lab just outside of Detroit, Lida Matman, professor emeritus at Wayne State University, has spent many decades studying all the different forms that bacteria can take and has published a textbook about them.
The first course in microbiology teaches everyone that bacteria have just a few shapes. They look like balls. You can think of them as basketballs. And they can occur in twos or groups or chains. Everybody's heard of streptococci. Well, these are these basketballs in chains. Or they're rods. They're just like sticks. That's the famous E. coli bacterium that's very much in the press now. Then there are spirochetes, and everybody's heard of syphilis. So you've got the three major types, the basketballs, the sticks, and the snakes.
But as Lida Matman has discovered, there are odd forms too, including what are called L forms of bacteria.
I first realized that there was such a thing as an L form when I held in my hand a test tube that was very cloudy with broth, and I had put some staphylococci in there. Staph aureus, they cause boils, you know, and they cause brain abscesses, and they're interesting organisms. But when I made a smear of it and stained it the way I taught students to do and the way I had been taught to do, I heat fixed it. You didn't see any organisms. Yet I could take a few drops of that and put it in fresh broth that wasn't cloudy, and a day it would get cloudy. And yet I'd make a smear, and there wouldn't be anything there. And I'd put it on a plate, and I didn't get any of these nice big gummy colonies that you could see with your naked eye. And then I realized there was something there that I was missing. And I've been looking at those missing things ever since. My students have done the quantitative work and shown that these are often 10 times more common than the kind we expect to see. This is the normal way bacteria grow. They grow at least twice as often this way, and often 10 times more in this cell wall deficient form. It's as though you only recognize the man when he had on his tuxedo. Really. Most of the time they're going around very casual. And without a nameplate, don't we wish they had a nameplate on? But they don't.
The only way to definitively identify these odd-shaped bacteria, Dr. Matman says, is by using very sophisticated biochemical techniques.
This conception is out that these are harmless. Well, they aren't harmless when they're in the body. They're causing meningitis and heart valve infections and myocarditis and kidney infections, and any part of the body could be attacked.
How do you know they're doing all this?
Because we find them in autopsies, and that's what you find. That's the form that the organism is in.
Those are samples from patients?
These are blood cultures. Mm-hmm. The patient's blood is settled out, but the cloudiness is growth of the organisms. you could put them back into animals and show they are pathogenic too.
Is there something different about this lab compared to other labs that allows you to be able to photograph and see these things?
I just take time, I guess, you know. I don't know, maybe as a teacher I had a little more time than I did as a clinician. I think maybe that's why I was able to get in this and stick with it, because somebody was telling me how many stains he has to look at in 1 hour. Well, you go swish, 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 and we spend 20 minutes on one smear. So it's a matter of time.
The kind of research Lida Matman is doing isn't exactly familiar to most of the doctors I spoke to who hadn't heard of this work. Dr. Garth Nicholson.
Much of the new molecular biology and molecular microbiology is really not present in medical training. And most of the physicians that are out there practicing may have received their training 10 or 20 years ago when none of this was presented. And the only bacteria that were known to cause disease were the classical ones, such as plague, for example, and other things. But now I think we're at the stage where we're investigating the role of many of these new types of infections. They're really not new, but I think there's an emerging awareness of the role of these infections in a variety of different disease processes, and it's going to only increase with time.
As new research is showing, there may be a lot more to bacteria than we thought. Richard Tilton.
As we are on the verge of a revolution in information technology, I think we have a similar revolution before our eyes with regard to the role of microorganisms in disease of humans. Who would have thought 10 years ago that ulcers would have been caused by Helicobacter? Who would have thought that cardiovascular disease could possibly be related to chlamydia pneumoniae? Who would have thought that dental caries were caused by strep mutans, that periodontal disease were caused by a variety of bacteria, and the list goes on and on.
Someone who's thought a lot about diseases that may be caused by bacteria is Paul Ewald. He's an evolutionary biologist at Amherst College who's fascinated by how quickly conventional thinking about diseases can change. He points to the complete about-face on what causes ulcers.
If you open a medical text from the 1970s, you'll see almost everything listed as a cause of ulcers except infection. And now we know that it's infection that's the main culprit, and that all these other factors, stress, maybe smoking, things like that, are exacerbating the problem, but they're not the primary causes. And this really does become pretty important because it suggests to us where we should be putting most of our effort. If we're interested in reducing atherosclerosis, if we knock out the organism, maybe some of these other risk factors are not going to be particularly important. So it's very important to distinguish what's just another risk factor from what's the primary cause of the problem.
That primary cause is turning out to be, more often than anybody imagined, bacteria. Paul Ewald will be back in our next program with some ideas he's developed as an evolutionary biologist about exactly which diseases are likely to be caused by bacteria. These ideas may generate as much controversy as there is today about Lyme disease. And what about certain types of heart disease? We'll visit a Canadian laboratory where research is going on at the forefront of the bacteria revolution. I'm Coleman Jones.
The Bacteria Revolution by Coleman Jones continues next Friday on Ideas. Production, Max Allen with Dave Field. I'm Mr. Sinclair. Please visit the Ideas website under www.radio.cbc.ca for an extensive illustrated story about the bacteria revolution. Our email address is ideas@cbc.ca.
You're listening to CBC Radio 1, News and More.
Hello.